You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Good evening and welcome. I'm thrilled to welcome you to Aloud's second program here at the beautiful Wallace. I want to thank our partners at the Wallace and thank all members and donors of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles who help make programs like this possible. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Aloud series, and I'm delighted to be welcoming Justice Breyer back for his second time to Aloud. If you'd like any information on how you can become a member of the Library Foundation and support the work of the Los Angeles Public Library, please speak to one of my colleagues in the lobby after the program tonight. Tonight we'll hear about the court and the world, American law and the new global realities, Justice Stephen Breyer's third book in a decade, which the author considers as much a mission as a book, to convince readers that American courts no longer have any choice about involving themselves in the laws beyond U.S. borders. To discuss this book and much else of interest, I'm sure, Justice Breyer will be in conversation with Jeffrey Toobin. And after about 50 minutes, we will open to some questions from the audience. We ask that you do ask a question, and we will circulate microphones so that we can hear you. So please wait until one comes to you. We have signed books by both of our authors available tonight for purchase, courtesy of our library store. We're very fortunate to have interviewing Justice Breyer, Jeffrey Toobin, whom the New York Times Book Review hailed as one of the most talented reporters covering the law in America today. Toobin, known for the skillfulness of his investigating and the power of his writing, is the best-selling author of The Oath, considered, quote, an essential guide to understanding the Supreme Court, The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson, which is currently being made into a miniseries just a few miles away from this theater. Really looking forward to it. John Travolta plays Robert Shapiro. Interesting. Jeffrey is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the senior legal analyst at CNN. At a recent reunion of his former law clerks for Justice Stephen Breyer, all of them attested to the justice's level of optimism and his belief in the possibility of positive change. Perhaps Justice Breyer's buoyancy is born of his experience in all three branches of government. He was a clerk for Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg at the Justice Department and U.S. Sentencing Commission and worked as counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1980 before leaving office. President Jimmy Carter named Breyer to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. He served 14 years in Boston, the last four as chief judge, and he was President Clinton's second nominee to the Supreme Court following Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1993, filling the seat formerly held by former Justice Harry Blackmun. He has now passed the two-decade mark on the high court, highest court in the land. I think we can all agree it's been an extraordinary year for the Supreme Court. This past term on the court, Justice Breyer, despite his liberal roots, was in the majority of decisions 92% of the time, more than any of his colleagues. He also delivered one of the most controversial dissents on the court's last day, June 29th, arguing that it's time for the justices to consider whether the death penalty remains constitutional. Unconstitutional. Yes, it is. He's not just a great jurist, said Strobe Talbot, president of the Brookings Institution, who introduced Justice Breyer at a recent event. He's also a great teacher. So be prepared to learn something over the next hour and a half, in our case, in the next 50 minutes, not just about the law, but also about how a fine mind works. Justice Breyer studied philosophy at Stanford and Oxford before studying the law at Harvard, where he also taught law for two decades. He's currently on the panel for the Pritzker Architectural Prize. He reads Proust in the original French. An interviewer at the New York Review of Books once asked Justice Breyer why he often emphasizes the beneficial role of artistic creation for everyone, to which he replied, quote, To me, the distinguishing characteristic of human beings is the desire to create order out of chaos, to give form to the universe. We are surrounded by colors, shapes, and sounds. We can arrange all these things in an attractive, constructive manner as a painting or a symphony, and that is what Proust did with his writing. Of course, he was supremely talented, but I firmly believe that every one of us can, to some extent, try to establish order amid chaos. We are indeed a fortunate country to have Stephen Breyer serving on the U.S. Supreme Court, attempting to establish order out of chaos. Please welcome Jeffrey Toobin and Justice Stephen Breyer.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. What a great crowd. What an honor to be here with Justice Breyer. So you had a good year, didn't you?
Seems to be.
No, seriously, did you think it was a momentous year at the time?
First, I want to thank you for being here. And I want to thank the library for inviting me. And I think what the library is doing is absolutely terrific. I mean, they're teaching children all over Los Angeles, through their sponsors and others, how to read. That's incredible. Now, I don't say that because I expect them to read this book. On the other hand, I don't expect all of them to read the book.
That's right. So what do you think about last year? I mean, was it a momentous year?
It was a year where I found that majorities agreed with me somewhat more than they had in previous years, and it's very unusual for someone to write an opinion and say he's wrong. I mean, I think I'm glad it worked out that way.
Let's talk about the Obergefell decision. That is the decision which said that marriage equality has to be in all 50 states. How, put the decision in some context, how big a decision do you think that is?
He knows perfectly well that the only thing I am less likely to talk about than cases that are directly in front of us are highly controversial, politically intense cases that we've just decided.
But it's over.
Do I think it's an important decision? Yes.
But all right, let me ask it this way.
You can ask it any way you want.
No, but in 1994, when you got on the Supreme Court, marriage equality existed in no states at all. The first state was Massachusetts in 2003. Now it's in all 50 states. How does that happen? How does the law change that way?
You know, people brought the cases, and they percolated in the lower courts, and there were divisions among the lower courts, and then it comes up to us. That's true of most cases that we decide. And the normal reason we have for taking a case is that there is a statute or a phrase in the Constitution, and people have applied it or interpreted it in different ways in the lower court. We call that a split in the circuits or a split among the lower courts, and then we're likely to take it because the primary objective of our court is to create a uniform federal law. That's what Chief Justice Taft said many, many years ago. We are not there to correct errors. Everyone has had a court case, a trial, an appeal. See, he's finding this boring.
I'm not finding it boring.
This is as far as I'm going to go. And that's, I was in the majority in that case. I'll add that.
That's a matter of public record, I think.
Yes, that's true. Yes,
but all right, let's step back and talk about it at a more general level. The law changes. No, I'm serious. Let's talk about the law changes sometimes. What is constitutional one day is unconstitutional later. How does that process work?
The best example and the most important example, probably more important even in the case you're talking about, is Brown versus Board of Education.
There you go. Almost 55 years earlier, in Plessy versus Ferguson, the court said separate but equal was okay. 1954, they said. So what happened in the interim? How did it change? What changed?
I think historians are better at answering that question than I am. But when I read it today, of course, I read it with my own eyes, as anyone in this audience would. You read it with your own eyes. You look at the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment says that no state shall deprive any person of equal protection of the law. Well, by 1954, if anyone was to say, to look around the South and say, are African-American people having equal protection of the law, that you'd have to have been blind and deaf and dumb not to be able to answer that question. No, they're not receiving equal protection of the law. Everyone knew that. And it was a question of getting it up to the courts and getting the court to decide it. Now, if you step back a stage, a lot of people think World War II was in part responsible for that because it showed that black people and white people were equally defending the United States of America. And it gave people contacts that they had been lacking before. Now, why do I bring up that kind of a point? A very interesting case, which I can't remember the name of, involved the 15th Amendment, which specifically says that you shall not deprive a person of the right to vote because of his race. Well, of course, that's just what was happening throughout the South. And there was an opinion that Holmes wrote. And if you read that opinion carefully, the issue came up to the court. And they went off on some ground that they didn't have to say that the 15th Amendment was being violated. And it was pretty transparent it was being violated. But Holmes wrote the opinion. And if you read that opinion, what I think he's saying is we can say all we want that you should give the same right to a black person as to a white person to vote, and they're not doing it. And nobody will follow what we say. And that's why I think a related case is extremely interesting in trying to understand Brown and what would change and what was going to happen. And that's Cooper versus Aaron. You remember that.
Yeah,
were you born?
I was not born. But
no.
I know this is a favorite case of yours. I've heard you talk about it. Why don't you
tell? It's not just a favorite case of mine.
We don't need a show of hands. Who knows Cooper versus Aaron? But I think you should. You need to put it in a little context to what the case is about.
Some of us, not you because you weren't born.
Right.
But some of us remember that in 1954, the court did decide Brown and said that you have to integrate the South. At least in the schools, it said that in Brown. And what happened in the rest of 1954 was nothing. And what happened in 1955 was nothing. What happened in 1956 was nearly nothing. What happened in 1957, a judge in Little Rock, federal judge, said integrate Central High School, and that's when Governor Falvey stood, in effect, in front of the schoolhouse door and said, you may have a court order, but I have the state militia. And we can remember, you look at the pictures of Elizabeth Eckford and those very brave Little Rock Nine who tried to go into that school, and they were turned away. And Elizabeth Eckford is there walking off, and you see a white girl, a high school student, as it turns out, in the background, her face just contorted with rage. My goodness. That picture went around the world. President Eisenhower and the governor had a meeting in Newport. The governor told President Eisenhower he would let the school be integrated, and then he went out and told the press the opposite. Mm-hmm. And what to do? And Eisenhower took advice. One of the advice given by Jimmy Burns, the governor of South Carolina, moderate on race and a former member of the Supreme Court of the United States. He'd left in World War II to run the logistical part of the war effort. He said to President Eisenhower, if you send troops, you'd better be prepared to occupy the entire South. And you better be prepared for a second Reconstruction. And the very best that will happen is they'll close all the schools, and no one will be educated. But Eisenhower listened to Herbert Brownell, his wise counselor, who said, you must, and he did. Within 2 or 3 days, he made up his mind. He went on the radio, and 1,000 troops from the 101st Airborne flew to Little Rock. And I tell that story because that's important. And he knew what he was doing, Eisenhower. The 101st were the people who had, every American knew them. They parachuted into Normandy in the invasion. They'd been hung up with their parachutes on the steeples and been shot down. They were the heroes of the Battle of the Bulge. And they took those nine and escorted them into the school. Now, that's an important story, but it's not the end of the story. The end of the story, which is longer, the end of the story is a new school board was elected. They said it's time not to integrate. Let's stop. They got a judge to agree. That case went to the Supreme Court. That was Cooper versus Aaron. And in Cooper versus Aaron, the entire court signed the opinion. That never happens. They all nine signed the opinion, said, integrate. Now you have the order. Do it. But they were nine judges, nine human beings, nine human beings. There could have been 90. There could have been 9,000. I mean, 9,000 or judges. And the day after they signed, after they decided that case, Governor Paubus closed the school. That's right. And Central High was closed. And read about what happened to the students there, white and black. Not a happy story. So, did the court win? Or was Holmes right? Well, I say, but I'm prejudiced. I'm a judge. Naturally, I favor what the judges did. I say, yes, it did make a difference. It did. Now, what happened? They couldn't keep it closed. Another school board was elected. And that was the time of Martin Luther King and the Freedom Riders and all kinds of things going on where bus boycotts and people in the North got interested and they went to the South. And with the help of all those people, eventually, the law was carried out. And that legal segregation, which took about 20 years to get rid of, and there's still problems, as we know. You see, that's the story. And so that's what you're after. You want to know, in this other case, about how public opinion might have affected what will really happen. And when I talk about Brown, and the reason I brought it up, and the reason that it is my favorite story, is because I've told that story, for example, to the president of the Supreme Court of Ghana in my office. And she is trying to bring about change. She has succeeded to a degree where the courts will be more instrumental in protecting democracy and civil rights in Ghana. And what she wants to know is, why do people in America do what you say, you judges? Good question.
Good question.
Good question.
Good question, absolutely.
And I will have to go through the history, including the history of, but that's another story, the history of instances where they didn't. And there have been many ups and downs, but what I want her to see is if she wants a rule of law, which indeed she does, and protection of democracy and human rights in Ghana, it's not the judges and the lawyers she has to talk to. I mean, contrary to popular belief, 314 million Americans are not lawyers. And I say in the United States and in Ghana, those are the people in the villages, in the towns, and so forth, that you have to convince. And you talk to them and get the lawyers to talk to them, and the day they're ready to accept opinions that they think affect them in a way they don't like and may even be wrong. Certainly in 5-4 cases, somebody's wrong. When they're willing to accept that against their interests, then you begin to have a rule of law. And it's taken a lot to bring that about in America. All right, there is a very long answer. And that is an answer that might not even be an answer. But it is something that I do believe fairly strongly. And you can apply it to the recent cases in whatever manner you wish.
Okay. You mentioned public opinion. You mentioned the influence of World War II on the civil rights decisions of the 1950s. There are members of your court who say, we shouldn't pay attention to current controversies. The Constitution means only what it meant when the framers wrote it, what the original meaning was, whether it was the original meaning of the Bill of Rights or the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, and all this stuff about World War II and public opinion and the changing society and the living Constitution is all wrong. What do you think about that?
There are two parts to what you said. And the first part is, should you as a judge pay attention to public opinion? And the answer, in my opinion, is no. They're right about that. You decide that case, whether it's the one you mentioned or some other one. Right. You decide it according to the law as you see it. And you do your best to get it right. And if it were just a question of what the public generally felt, how would you in fact have a constitution that applies equally to the least popular person in the United States as to the most popular person in the United States? That's the ideal, and that's what you try to bring about. And you leave to you, the observers, the writers, the historians, to write about how in the long run, opinion might have some effect on the way the court sees things and so forth. But that's not my job. My job is, in fact, to interpret and to apply the Constitution as I believe is proper in the individual cases, even if it's the least popular thing to do. That's what the job is, and people try to live up to that. Now, the second part of what you asked is the question of, in carrying out that job, do you just pay attention to what the framers thought, or do you look to current conditions? And I reject the dichotomy.
Okay.
Because, for the most part, the framers didn't answer the questions directly that we have in front of us. What they did, for the most part, in the Constitution is incorporate certain values, such as freedom of expression. When I've discussed this with Justice Scalia publicly, as we do and have, and it's interesting, and I'll say, George Washington didn't know about the internet. And he will say, I knew that.
Yes.
And what really is at issue there, in my opinion, is the degree to which you look around imaginatively at what conditions were like in the 18th century, and then say that when they wrote the words, they were incorporating those conditions. Now, there we probably disagree on that amount of degree, because I think, like every other judge, when we interpret a statute or we interpret the Constitution, we look at the words. They're surely relevant. If it says vegetable, it doesn't mean animal. All right? You look at the history, you look at the purposes or the values, you look at the traditions, you look at the consequences that are relevant to that purpose. And some people pay more attention to consequences and purposes or values. And some pay more attention just to the history and the tradition and the precedent. And I put B in the first category and him in the second category.
Fair
and
enough.
There we are.
What did you say about the death penalty at the end of the term?
I said I thought that it's time to re-examine the constitutionality of the death penalty.
Why?
And I back that up with 46 pages, which I'm very surprised you all haven't read.
You're making it. They may have.
They
you
may
don't
have.
Know that.
No, it's the children who they. Well, in any case, the basic reason, I said, if you looked at it, and we have a considerable amount of sort of what I'd call references to studies and so forth, but sometimes it's the wrong person, irreparable. Often it is arbitrary because the people who are actually executed are not the worst of the worst quite often, and the ones who are executed are, they're all kinds of unfortunate reasons why I think it's a fair conclusion to say it's applied arbitrarily. I put those in. Between a time a person is sentenced to death, those who are executed, 18 years on average, there are cases where it's 30 years or so. One about 30 years, and they found out he was innocent because of DNA after 30 years on death row. And it's diminished a lot. I mean, what you'll see is that it's just a handful of counties in the United States and where the death penalty is actually carried out. And maybe 30 or so people were executed. I think it's about 20 up to date now this year. It's a big drop. So the phrase is cruel and unusual. the arbitrary, I thought I'd quoted Justice Stewart years ago, said, if you are a terrible killer, the chance of your being executed is the same as being hit by lightning. That was his view. But you see, I've given you the thrust of the opinion. And I'm saying, look at all these changes. Look at the facts as we know them now. It's time to re-examine the matter.
So I brought my copy of the Constitution here. And the Fifth Amendment says, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless there's a grand jury. So the Constitution itself contemplates capital offenses.
It has a provision that refers to it.
So how can it be unconstitutional to have a death penalty if the Constitution itself refers to the death penalty?
It doesn't say that whether the death penalty is or is not constitutional. We know at the time they wrote that it was. And also, it probably was constitutional, or at least they might have thought so, to have flogging, because they had flogging as a punishment. So, it does say that, that's true. So, does it say you have to have that forever?
You're the justice. I'm just asking the question.
But the questions you're asking, and I rephrase it in terms of questions, because I want to go as far as I can to give you an answer, that's the kind of issue that I'm certain will be raised if the court adopts what I said does reconsider this matter.
What was so interesting about your opinion is that, which Justice Ginsburg joined, Justice Blackmun, your predecessor, and Justice Stevens, both of whom came on the Supreme Court as you did without opposing the death penalty in all circumstances, after about the same amount of time on the court, after about two decades on the court, essentially said, enough. I just can't do this anymore. And believe me, I'm paraphrasing. But it just, all four of you, after about 20 years on the court, said, I've tried to apply the Constitution to the death penalty, and I just can't do it anymore. What is it about being a judge, seeing these cases year after year, that inspires very similar conclusions, at least among four very prominent members of the court?
Well, I can't speak for others, but I think it's a fair statement to say what comes through my dissent is I'm drawing on my experience there. And if I were to underline a conclusion that I think may affect them too over time, is the word arbitrary. The word arbitrary. Because certainly you see over and over and over many, many, many cases. And I wrote it down, and I think probably the pages on which I wrote those words will convey better than I could now what the nature of the experience has been to lead me to the conclusion that I reached.
Different subject area. I noticed a sort of interesting symmetry about your career, and dealing in rough numbers here. You've been on the court for a little more than 20 years. You served with Chief Justice Rehnquist for 10 years, Chief Justice Roberts for 10 years. What does a Chief Justice do?
Well, I can tell you for 11 years I was junior justice, i.e. the most recent, I can tell you what the junior justice does, which is he opens the door in the conference in case someone knocks and brings people coffee if someone's there with a coffee mug.
Were you not almost the longest tenured junior justice in the history of the court?
I was almost, but if only Sam Alito could have waited 11 more days, then I would have been. I could have gone down in history as the answer to a trivia question.
That's right.
But
what does the Chief Justice do?
He has one vote, like everyone else, and he assigns. Well, the person who assigns the opinion to be written after the discussion in conference, where they're alone in conference. We'll discuss the cases that we heard that week. The Chief Justice begins the discussion, states the issue, and then says, I think so-and-so, da-da-da-da-da. You can do it pretty concisely and quickly. Each of us have books. I'll write down what he says. We each write down what the others say. If I have to write an opinion, I better know what the others say and think. Then we'll go to Justice Scalia. Justice Kennedy, Justice Thomas, Justice Ginsburg, me, Alito, Sotomayor, Kagan. And then we have some discussion back and forth. And on the basis of that, we reach a tentative conclusion. It can change, and sometimes it does. It changes in various ways as the opinions are written. Who writes the opinion? For a particular case, it is up to the Chief Justice to decide who writes it if he's in the majority. About half are unanimous. About 20% are 5-4. Not always the same 5 or 4. But the Chief Justice, where he's in the majority, will choose who writes. If he's not in the majority, whoever is senior in the order I said will decide who writes. Now, in making that decision, he's more constrained than you might think.
How so?
Well, for one thing, we have an informal rule, which is, I think, always followed, that in writing a case, everyone is assigned one opinion before anyone is assigned two. And then everyone is assigned two before everyone is assigned three. You see, so the workload evens out across the year. Then, of course, he can't decide. I mean, he has to try to get a court. He wants to keep at least five people. So I discovered when I was junior, how to get an opinion. A tough case, 4-4, it comes to me. You know how I can be sure it will be assigned to me?
How?
I just say, I'm not sure.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. That happened once.
You said,
oh,
once?
My God, was I sorry I said that. but you see,
can I just, in conference?
Yes.
You know, it is of course, the holiest of holy. Only the justices are present. And you go around the table and vote. How often does someone say, God, I don't know. I just can't make up my mind.
Very rarely.
Yeah, I would think
and,
that's
but
part of
what
the job.
Will happen is people will say, I'm tentative. Or they might say, and I'm tentative. It sometimes happens that they're more willing to change. And maybe once in, or two and twice in maybe 3 years, the whole thing flips. You see, the whole thing flips. That's happened. How you write the opinion can often change. Tentativeness is a mark of tentativeness. And if I hear somebody else say they're tentative, I'll be careful to try to keep them on board if I'm writing. And occasionally someone will say this, I don't want to say now, I want to think about this for a day or so, but I'll send a memorandum around. That happens maybe several times in the year, or a few times. But it's rare. And so normally, you can't, we're judges, the court is a court, its job is not to sit there and theorize forever. The case has to be decided. You have to decide the case, decide it, and on to the next case. And after a while, for 3 or 4 years, you're frightened to death. You really am. And then eventually you realize, well, there we are. I have to do my best, and I'm doing my best. And that's the amount most people can expect. And you see, it's much more like, Tony Kennedy said this, it's more like an express train. Things keep coming through. They keep coming through. You have to decide, not instantly. You have time to think about it. You have arguments put in front of you. You go through them and you can discuss them, which you do. But then eventually, it's time to write an opinion or it's time to join an opinion. And when that opinion has been written, majority, dissent, joined, the decision comes out.
How are Chief Justice Rehnquist and Chief Justice Roberts similar, and how are they different?
I'd say they're similar. They both did a good job in the conference. I mean, they articulate very clearly what the issues are, and they usually have very good reasoning backing up their opinions and their decisions. And they have to both recognize the need to try to get a court. The country doesn't want to know the Constitution according to Breyer or O'Connor or somebody or Scalia or somebody else. What the country needs is a decision as to what those words mean. And so it's very important to try to get five people on one decision. And both Rehnquist and Roberts will try pretty hard. And I think that's quite good. I would say Chief Justice Roberts tends to tolerate or become interested in somewhat, a little bit more discussion in the conference than Chief Justice Rehnquist. Rehnquist you see, we go around, then there's some back and forth, and then when Rehnquist felt that it wasn't being productive. See, at no point am I just trying to make an argument. Were there a lot of arguments? If you have start with, I listen to what you say, and I'm saying something that will, in fact, respond and maybe affect what you say, but I'm listening, then it's productive. The instant it becomes non-productive, the instant it becomes I have a better argument than you, forget it.
And I've heard you say frequently that, you know, you've never heard a cross word in conference. People are as contentious as these issues are, it's a civilized discourse.
That's true. I've not heard a voice raised in anger. I've not heard one judge say something mean or deprecating or insulting about another, not as a joke or anything. It's very professional. It's very professional. It goes around the table. It is absolutely civil. And people do disagree. And the audience I like to tell that to are the law students and the college students. And I just did it at the Constitution Center on Constitution Day. It was a great audience. It's 350 high school students. And I told them, I said, when you get into an argument, you start raising your voice. I mean, fine. What does the other person think? Maybe the other person thinks you don't have such a good point. That's why you're getting emotional. And they took that in. They absolutely took that in.
Let me play devil's advocate on that issue as well. I mean, shouldn't we care as citizens more that you come out the right way on these issues than that you get along with each other?
Yes.
I mean, so, I mean...
But you asked me if we got along with each other, and so I...
No. I guess my question is about how important and valuable it is that you get along with each other. Because historically, the court has had a lot of contention under Chief Justice Rehnquist and Roberts, much less than some of the contentious relationships in the past.
Sandra O'Connor told me, and it's true, that there are two unwritten rules that are important, particularly. One is no one speaks twice until everyone speaks once. When I was junior,
in conference, yes.
Yeah, it's correct, in the conference. And as junior, I appreciated that rule. And it gives people the impression who are participating that they're all being listened to. Very good idea. The second is tomorrow is another day. That is to say, we were at odds in case one, maybe fiercely so. But now case two has nothing to do with case one, and we might be the best of allies. And that's important, very important, because it helps to assure that the decisions are made on the merits of the law and that personality does not enter into it. And I think a civil discussion where people make a conscious effort to get along well with people who disagree with them very much on the merits, I think that very much helps bring about a circumstance where each decision is decided independently on the law and not because someone is irritated with someone else.
You know, those of us in the news media often describe the Supreme Court as the four Democratic appointees, the five Republican appointees, the liberal bloc, the conservative bloc with Kennedy in the middle. Is that right? Is that fair? Is that accurate?
Well, that's your job.
But we're open to criticism.
Well, you are.
Yeah.
Yes, so are we. So are we. I would say I think it's unfortunate. I think that, and indeed, people used to think that when David Souter and John Stevens were there, and that's why you changed the way you phrased it, because you knew perfectly well that they were appointed by Republican presidents.
But that's when there used to be moderate Republicans in the universe. I was me, not you, I'm just...
It's unfortunate because it produces it's our problem then. I mean, you do that because you think it's something that your readers would like to know. And your job primarily is to put in the paper those things that you think your readers would like to know. It produces for us what I think is the most serious problem facing the courts. And that is the problem that people think, particularly the Supreme Court, that we're junior varsity politicians. And I think that's terribly unfortunate. And when I hear people ask that, I know where they're coming from, and I'll say, you think that, well, look, we're 50% of the time unanimous, 20% 5-4, and it's maybe half of them are the usual suspects and almost half not of those 5-4. And then they'll say, yes, but the important ones are the usual suspects. And then I say, well, yeah, the ones the press thinks are important because they have the greatest public interest. They aren't always the most important, but then that doesn't get me anywhere. And then then I say, what is the truth, though it takes a minute, is that I did work for Senator Kennedy. I did work in the Senate. So when you say political, I think what it used to mean to a Senate staffer, where are the votes? Are you a Republican or a Democrat? Is it going to make you my senator more popular or less popular? I don't see that in the Supreme Court. And you will say, oh, what about Bush v. Gore? And I say, I need an hour to convince you on that one, and I have to be satisfied with making you say, well, maybe. All right. No, I don't see it. And you say, well, I don't mean politics. I mean ideology. Are you an Adam Smith free enterpriser? Are you a Marxist troublemaker, a Maoist or something? I say, if I see myself writing an opinion, and I think that's what's leading me to write, I know I'm doing the wrong thing. But there is a third thing, which is I did grow up in San Francisco. I did go to Lowell High School. I did grow up during the 1950s. I've lived the life I've led, and so have you. And all of us, by the time we get along a bit, have views at a very abstract level, perhaps, but in the case of a lawyer, what the law is really about, how it helps people or doesn't, how this Constitution fits to help Americans live together. You have basic views on that, and those basic views might be somewhat different than someone else's, but those basic views are yours, and you can't jump out of them anymore. You can jump out of your own skin. And that does explain some of the differences, people's basic approach. And different presidents will try to appoint people with different basic views. If they try to appoint people to decide always for them, they're in for a surprise. And that's it, you know. But you see where I'm going. You understand the point. And at that level, I think it's okay.
Before we open it up to questions, I want to make sure to talk about your book. Why'd you write a book about the court in an international setting?
Probably I wrote this book because I've seen something change over the course of time. And what I've seen change is that we have many more cases where you must know something about what's going on beyond these shores if you're to decide the case correctly.
Forgive me for interrupting, but even in the 20 years you've been on the court, you write in the book, your docket, the kind of cases you get, have become much more international. And those are mostly, it seems to me, based on what you write about, a lot of them are business-related cases.
Well, that's part of it. But, I mean, some of them are human rights cases.
Guantanamo and...
That's a security. Security, yeah. Civil rights. That kind of balance. There are cases involving human rights. There are cases involving domestic relations. There are cases involving, and I have 274 carefully written pages that will describe the kinds of cases. I mean, Dolly Phil Artiga comes to the United States from Paraguay, where she has, or her brother was tortured to death by the dictator and his police, and she finds the Paraguayan policeman in New York, and she also finds an old statute written almost 200 years ago, perhaps to help victims of pirates. She brings a lawsuit under that statute and obtains damages in New York. And she went back to Paraguay saying, I wanted to look that torture in the eye, and I came away with so much more. Well, as a result of that case in the 70s, many more cases were brought in the human rights area, and they pose questions of tremendous difficulty. Who are today's pirates? But more than that, what happens if South Africa says, as they did say, we are dealing with the victims of apartheid, we have a system called Truth and Reconciliation, we don't want federal judges in the United States getting involved. What happens if, in fact, you have to have an interpretation which, if other countries use, it has to work out? So it doesn't just interfere, get all mixed up, and create a kind of chaos. That's the kind of challenge, legally, that is right in front of the court several times in the human rights area, which is not yet perfectly resolved. As you say, in the commerce area, I mean, you have to know to decide securities cases what kind of enforcement devices there are, anti-fraud devices, in Europe, in Australia, in other places, because you have to interpret our statutes so that they work in harmony with those other statutes to achieve the common objective. We had in front of us Mr. Kurtzang from Thailand.
I love that case. Yeah.
I did, too. I wrote the opinion, but it was a... But what?
No, obviously that's why I love it, so go ahead. No, it's a very interesting case. Well, please.
The point that I want to make...
Only one of us actually wrote the Supreme Court opinion about it, so I think he should talk about it, yeah.
No, he's a student at Cornell. He discovers that his textbooks are about half the price, or a lot cheaper in Thailand, the same textbook. So he writes to his family and says, send me a few. And they sent him some. In fact, they sent more than a few. And he began to sell them. And the publisher got annoyed and sued him. And we had to interpret a very technical provision of the statute to see whether it was legal or not what he did. We eventually decided it was legal. But very complicated, very technical. So why do I bring it up? Because suddenly I discover in that case, as we all did, briefs filed by lawyers all over the world. They're filed by lawyers from Britain, from Japan, from all over the place. And why are there all these briefs there? And the reason is because copyright today is not just about books or music or films or even your miniseries, which I'll certainly watch. But the copyright, I mean, automobiles are filled with software, and the software is copyrighted. So if you go buy a car in San Francisco or here in an auto dealer and you want to resell it, if it's made in Detroit, there's no problem. Is there a problem if it was made in Tokyo? And you go into any shop you want and look at the label, and those labels will be copyrighted in all probability. And we are told in the briefs that this case, how you come out, will affect $3 trillion worth of commerce. Even today, $3 trillion is a lot of money. And you cannot answer that question without knowing something about how copyright works in other places, publishers' trade practices, all kinds of things. That's the obvious commercial area. Or we can go to Guantanamo, and I can talk about, which I won't...
Before we get to that, there's one controversial corner of this issue, which particularly comes up in the death penalty context. It came up in your opinion this year, which is, should we look to the law of other countries? You point out in your opinion that only 22 countries in the world at this point execute anyone at all. Should we be part of that group? And some of your colleagues on the court say, we don't care what other countries do. They don't have our constitution. They don't have our rule of law. We should not look to the law of other countries. What do you think about that?
I write something about that because I know a lot of people think that. And there are a lot of good answers to that. And Professor Waldron wrote a whole book giving all these answers to it. And I've used those answers. Sometimes I say, what's wrong in a case like that? It says unusual. The founders didn't tell us whether the death penalty word unusual in the Eighth Amendment, forbidding cruel and unusual punishments, whether unusual refers to the world or refers to this country. And so why not look to see what we have to learn from other countries? And I can make the argument in many areas, what's wrong with looking to see what other judges do? They have documents like ours. They have problems like ours. They try to protect basic liberties like we do. If they have a similar problem, a similar document, a similar job, why don't I read what they say? Doesn't hurt. Doesn't bind us. I've made those arguments many times.
And
it doesn't move anybody who isn't already convinced.
Well, no, I mean, for example, in Justice Kennedy's opinion, where he said that we could no longer execute juvenile offenders, he said that the only four countries in the world that executed juvenile offenders were, I believe, Iran, Congo, Russia, and the United States. Is that company that we want to be in? I thought that was a good point. Yes, I mean, you were on that opinion. I thought that was, you know, so it's not like that's totally unpersuasive to people.
No,
yeah,
it isn't. But what I worry about is there are quite a few who aren't persuaded. And the purpose of this book is to really say to them, I would like you to see what our docket is actually like. I would like you to see the challenges that are going to face us. Through the fact, for example, and you probably perhaps know this because you may have read this with the microscope that it deserves, but how many organizations do you think there are in the world created by treaty, setting up bureaucracies, which make rules for more than one nation?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
Would you say it's more like 50 or more like 500?
I would say 50, and I'd be wrong because that's not as interesting as if it's 500.
It's not 500.
What is it?
2,000.
2,000?
And we belong to about several hundred. And those rules are coming out, and they bind us in practice. Whether they bind us in law is a good question, to be decided. Now, that's the world we're in. And many of those cases have begun to come up in different forms in the Supreme Court. And we face problems in the world, environment, security, health, dozens of them. And if the answer is that we cannot create such organizations and then abide by them, how are we going to solve the problem? But if the sky is the limit under the Constitution, what happens to the legislative power of Congress? And how do we assure fair procedures? And how do we give you or any one of us a voice in what is actually happening? Now, I can only describe problems like that. And that's one of a set of problems. And I want to say to the people who were making the argument, I'd like you to start thinking about the challenges that are really in front of us now that go by this word, globalization or interdependence, which for most people is a buzzword. But I want to make that absolutely concrete. And now what I'm hoping is that what's actually moving you when you make the argument that you were making, not you, but the person you were imagining.
Right, yeah.
That you want, you're worried about referring to foreign cases because you're afraid that somehow that will dilute basic American values such as democracy, human rights, rule of law, widespread commerce, and so forth. That's what's moving you. Very well. I hope by the time you get to chapter 16, you will think that the only way to preserve basic American values in the world as it now is and is becoming more so every day is to participate and to look beyond our shores and for judges, too, to begin to understand in these cases what happens in relevant areas elsewhere in the world, for there is no other way to meet the kinds of legal challenges that this interdependent world is throwing up to all of us, including the Supreme Court of the United States. I want to bring them along.
Okay. I want to go to questions, but I want to do two. I want to do two questions that often come up in forums like this. Cameras in the courtroom. When's that happening?
I don't know.
What are you for? And your Supreme Court. We'll deal with other.
What I've said, and it hasn't been something I've had to vote on. What I've said is there are good arguments both ways. You're probably talking about cameras in oral proceedings.
Yes.
Now I'd say one thing in favor of it is it'd be terrific educationally.
Indeed, would see nine
people really trying to do a job where there are good arguments on both sides much more often than people think.
Why doesn't Justice Thomas ask any questions?
You have interrupted.
I apologize. No, but you said nine.
You can interrupt. I've only given the argument that you're favorable to us. Now that you're on to Justice Thomas not asking questions, he's a good friend. I admire him very much. And he is totally up on every case. The way he decides things is he reads And he goes away and thinks about it. He's listening to what's going on. He'll think about it. He'll come to a conclusion, and he'll write it down. I am a former professor. Professors are talky. And very often, the way they take things in best is by talking them out. Those are different styles. They have nothing to do with how you're thinking about the case or how you're deciding it. Right? And that is a fact. I've been there for, I understand that. Now, to go back to the other thing, think of the arguments on the other side. The concern on the other side, I think, if I'm first, the oral argument is about 3% of how we decide something. I mean, it's almost all in writing. The oral argument is a little bit of it. And I don't think people would know that. Second, people do relate to people they've seen more than to people they read about. And there'd be the bad one and the good one. But we have to decide a case knowing that the decision affects 315 million Americans. It's for people outside the courtroom that we're mostly deciding. So we don't know if people will get the right impression. But if you come right down to it, you could say, so what? Let's see what happens. And the trouble with let's see what happens is, I would say, the word distortion. That's the concern.
Can I make
a... Now, I don't say it's a correct concern. Maybe it would be done perfectly. Maybe it isn't true that the first time that somebody wrote, you know, showed a picture looking like Torquemada and out of context, because I only look like Torquemada 4 hours a day and the rest of the time it's fine. But you see, would that change the behavior of people in the court? And I don't know if that's sufficient argument. I don't know if that's sufficient to outweigh the good. But we're a very conservative institution with a small c. And whatever the arguments are, we don't want to be the people that have taken this institution, which on balance has done pretty well for America, and done something that hurts it. That's the emotional part that's going on. And I suspect eventually, to answer your question, there will be people on the court because generations grow up and the membership changes, and they won't even understand what I'm talking about when I say the negative side. And then you will have...
But, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting is that Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor, in their confirmation hearings, both of them said, you know, I think cameras in the courtroom are a good idea. And after they got to the court, they started to have Stockholm syndrome, and they're now opposed. And I do think that the issue of protecting the institution and not wanting to put in lights and cameras.
There's another which is hard to evaluate. You know, but do you think it would be a good idea when a president is appointing a justice to take into account how he appears on television?
Well, I mean, public presentation? That's a good question. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's good. If you say question. You don't know, you're now getting over to my boat.
Okay.
Which is I think.
All right. One more question. Mandatory retirement or term limits? What do you think?
Good.
Your favorite?
Yes. No, I wouldn't put it that way.
What
I'd say is this.
How would you?
I want to stay out of it. I'd say that it probably, from a personal point of view as well as an institutional point of view, it would be fine to have a long term. It would have to be a long term. I mean, maybe 15, 18, I don't know, 18 years. You do not want the person who's in that job to be thinking about what's his next job. That's important. So it would have to be a long term. But if it's a long term, fine. I mean, it would make things easier, actually, because you'd know you'd be there for a certain time, and then the decision would be made. And I don't really see anything wrong with that, provided it's long. And that's for the reason I said. Now, that's not going to happen, I don't think, because you'd probably have to change the Constitution,
yes,
and opening that Constitution up for, I don't know what would happen. That's a can of worms that I'm not too confident. I don't know if that would be the only change and so forth. So I don't think it's likely to occur.
You sort of raised the issue of when people decide to leave.
Yeah.
What will go into your decision?
I'll think it's time to leave.
Will you say to yourself...
It's not different. I mean, that position is not different than the position of many, many people in this audience or many people. You have to work out when is it the right time to leave. And, of course, it would be easier for me if there were a fixed term of years.
Chief Justice Rehnquist, I heard say, well, we have a sort of informal tradition that we leave when a president in the party that appointed us left. It is in office. Isn't that something? Would that something that would weigh in your considerations?
I'll know much more about this when I decide to leave.
Which will not be soon. Okay, let's... let's bring up the lights here in near Hollywood. We're not in Hollywood. We're here in Beverly Hills. And who has some questions? And I have no jurisdiction over who asks, so I think... Well, actually, maybe I do. How about that woman up in the green? All right. Or, well, pick somebody. Let's go. Oh, I was a different green. Okay. That green next. Hold it closer.
Okay. There has been a great deal written in the press, as well as popular sentiment, about Citizens United.
Okay, but you got to ask a question. Let's move along.
Yeah. Do you see a possibility that the court could revisit it?
Citizens United holds that trades unions and corporations cannot be limited in the amount they independently spend on television advertising during the last 6 months of the campaign. Now, do you mean revisit that? Or do you mean revisit a lot of other things that have been read into it? It's easier...
The latter.
The latter. Yeah, well, who knows? I was in dissent.
Next. Okay.
A number of people felt that certain justices should have recused themselves in certain situations. The situation of Clarence Thomas and his wife in the health care bill was one such example. Do you have any thoughts on whether there should be something more formal about when justices do recuse themselves?
For recusals, there are nine volumes, I think, or there are quite a few volumes, of something called the Judicial Code, which goes into that in depth. In any recusal case, though a member of the Supreme Court is not legally bound to do so, but what actually happens in practice is people look through those volumes, and where recusal is required, they recuse themselves. So I don't think there's a difference between a lower court judge and a Supreme Court justice in respect to what actually happens, but one. There is this difference. When I was on the Court of Appeals, if I would get into a case where there was a possibility of a recusal, it could be a fairly far out question. Probably recusal isn't required, but there is an argument for it. I can see it. I will lean on the side of recusal. Take myself out of the case. Why not? They can find another judge. Why have to get into all that? There are plenty of judges. They're fungible. That is not true of the Supreme Court. If I take myself out of a case, that can change the result because there is no way to get a substitute. And so I have to be pretty careful about not taking myself out of a case where I don't have to recuse myself, just as I have to be careful to take myself out in a case where I should. Now, I promise lawyers are awfully imaginative, and they're pretty, if you're too ready to recuse yourself, they'll find very good reasons for you to do it. So what I do is I read the books, and there are some people who are ethics professors who I'll call.
How many years?
And that's I'm giving you the system. And that system applies pretty universally as far as I know.
How many cases a year do you recuse yourself in?
Oh, I recuse myself a lot because my brother is a sitting judge. So if
with his cases.
Charles
Breyer is a federal district judge in San Francisco.
Yeah. So if it's his case, if we get 8,000 a year. We got 8,000 requests, and each of those is potentially a recusal. And so if he said in a case, I'll take myself out of that cert, and we try to catch them all. I can't say we've caught all of them, but we try to. And then you recuse yourself. That's the other thing. If not too much, I mean, you try to, insofar as you have savings or invest them in something, it's better in a mutual fund, but it applies to your wife and your so forth. And so sometimes there's a stock, if you own stock in the company. That's sometimes the basis for recusal. But I don't think if you look into the details, you'd find them unsatisfactory.
Is it just for you? Is it one a year? Is it two a year?
I don't know. With Chuck, I mean, because the 8,000, you'd have to go look at the list. Right. I don't even look at it. My secretary just does it automatically. My law clerks go through each of those 150 or so every week to be sure it isn't Chuck, and to check them against the list of a handful of stocks that I or my wife own. And that's what it is, and you'd have to look at the list to find out how it's all public.
Next question.
Hi, Justice Breyer. Do you have any advice for young lawyers who hope to follow in your footsteps and become a judge?
Being a judge, there being a federal judge, which is what I was, you have to be in a way struck by lightning. To be on the Supreme Court, lightning has to strike in the same place twice, maybe three times. I mean, so you don't know. There isn't anything in particular. My father used to say, which I think is always good advice. So his main advice was stay on the payroll. But but he used to say, do your job as well as you can do it, and try to pay attention to what other people think when you're doing that job. And someone might notice you're doing this well and so forth, and you might get a job you like more. On the other hand, they might not notice. But if they haven't noticed, you at least have the satisfaction of having done your job well. And that's how he tried to conduct himself, and I think that's as good a way as any. There is no magic. There is no secret that I am aware of. And every one of us who is on the court, I promise you, knows perfectly well that that wheel could have landed on any one of a dozen other people at least. And you've done very well in your career. If anybody, I mean, I considered myself to have done well when I was considered and not chosen. But that's about, beyond that. And I want you to think, I don't think I answered the Citizens United thing, because I think most people really don't understand there is a lot to be said for the other side. And it is a good example of how these things, there are two sides to it. I mean, after all, the First Amendment does say Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And the argument, well, this is money, it's not speech, I don't find that convincing. How do you, in this country, in any political race, get your views across without money? You can't. So if you say no money, you silence the person. Now, Learned Hand, who is one of our greatest judges, said, do not get involved in the process of deciding how much money is too much to give. He said, don't do that, because you'll find Congress is cleverer than the judges. And before you know it, they'll write themselves into office. All right? Don't do it. What is too much? You, Breyer, he might have said. In a case in Vermont, said that a $100 limit on contributions was too little, because it did write people into office. You couldn't even buy coffee. I mean, coffee in Vermont is expensive, but not that expensive. But you see the point. And you're in that business of saying how much is too much, or at least ratifying Congress when they say it. Now, those are not bad arguments. I personally was not convinced by them. But I want you to see that there are decent arguments. And I thought the countervailing argument, which was, first, I'm sorry, where the average person can just give $5 or $10 or maybe $100, and somebody gives $20 million, that discrepancy is just too great. And what it will do is it will cut the connection between public opinion, which is normally the voice of many, that marketplace of ideas, and the legislative outcome. One of the reasons that Madison wanted that First Amendment to make that connection so that the legislators would have to listen to what's going on in that marketplace of ideas. But if you have $20 million or $2 million or $5 million or something, that's what will determine the outcome. Who gets in the office? Not the marketplace of ideas. And even if that weren't true, people will think it's true. And if they think it's true, that's enough to slow down or stop the political discourse. Now, that discrepancy and that problem with the connection of idea to reality seemed to me enough to say that the majority in Citizens United is wrong. I say that because I don't want to have convinced you that they were right. I think they're not right. But I do want you to see that is in many controversial cases, when the arguments come up to us, there are pretty good arguments on both sides of the question. And what I think about that case in the dissent, well, naturally, I think the dissent was correct.
If you're interested, Justice Breyer writes about this issue in his book, Act of Liberty, which was two books ago, which is a very interesting discussion of precisely these issues. Next question.
And this will be our final question.
This will be our final question.
Would you please comment on the press reports of the shrinking docket? The shrinking docket.
Shrinking docket.
Oh, why we have fewer cases. We were talking about that not very long ago. I don't know. I mean, it is what he's referring to is that we're deciding about 75, maybe, cases in a year.
And if you go back, just in the 80s, it was
double. Yeah, it was double that. And it's not a question of any intent. We take cases primarily because the lower courts have come to different conclusions on the same issue. And that's the primary driving force. And if they're not there, they're not there. Now, normally in the conference, Sandra O'Connor used to sit there and say that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we've got to take more cases. And the general view is we want to take more cases. Now, I know every single lawyer who's filed a case that's been rejected will say that can't be right because mine was right. But nonetheless, that I promise is the feeling. So why? And my own view, which is not special, I don't have special knowledge on it, is that what's likely to... Well, it actually goes back to 1584, to Montaigne. What he said was that whenever you have a words, lawyers make arguments. Every word is another argument. Every word is a disagreement. So if you have a period where Congress is passing a lot of legislation, with some lag, 3 or 4 years, 5 years after that, you're going to get a lot of cases. And if you particularly had the Civil Rights Revolution of the 60s and 70s, that produced all kinds of cases. And before that, there was less discretion for reasons of law, what the court's docket was like. Now, if I'm right about that, we'll have a test, because now we've seen legislation in the medical, healthcare, securities regulation, Dodd-Frank, and so forth. There are a lot of words in those statutes. And we are beginning to see them. We are beginning to see them. And I suspect if there are more statutes, we will find our docket growing. But I can't prove it. And there may be other reasons, and maybe you can find them, but I would be interested. Do you want to do one more?
You should
do
one. You're the justice. One more. That woman in green has been extremely enthusiastic,
yes.
But you need to get a microphone and... we put away... Well, just talk louder.
I can talk.
Yeah, talk loud.
Would you mind, Justice Breyer, digressing from the court for a moment to talk about that magnificent courthouse in Boston? It's an extraordinary building.
Thank you.
Can you...
Yes.
do that in the context of talking about your work on the Pritzker Prize, which is very interesting. And just tell people what the Pritzker Prize is if they don't know.
It's a prize for architecture, and probably I'm on that committee because of the courthouse. I mean, Judge Woodlock and I spent about a day a week for about 3 years working with the architect, Harry Cobb, who's a great architect, fabulous. He's at Pei, Cobb, and Freed, but I am Pei. And what we were trying to do, and that was what, in a way, this book tour, et cetera, the nicest thing was that CBS, for me personally, was when CBS took a picture of the courthouse. And what we were trying to do, and which Cobb, Harry sat there, just as in Los Angeles, Frank Gehry sat with the symphony orchestra for a period of time before he designed the new symphony. And he did that to try to understand what their job was like. And Harry Cobb sat in the courtrooms for a period of time trying to figure out what the litigant's job was, what the judge's job was, and so forth. And then he designed a building. He showed us, and why he was chosen, really, over some very, he showed us a picture of a courthouse in early 18th century Virginia, the 1710 or something. He said, look at that courthouse. There is a spire. That means a public building. There is a porch. It's in the square, and people gather in that porch, the portico. The public gathers in that porch in the evening to talk about whatever they want. And then there's a courtroom where the people, where the job of the judge is carried out. Now, how do we reproduce that in a world where there are 18 courtrooms in the courthouse, not one, and where it's too expensive to have a big spire or a dome? So you have it in the San Francisco, in the city hall. You have a big dome, same thing, and the courtrooms go off of it. But you try some of the modern ones. You ask, what is that building? Is it a courthouse, or is it a hospital, or is it an apartment house? Or is it a bureaucracy? You see, a judge, that's why we are interested in law, in part. A judge and the lawyers, why go into law? What I tell the students is because you have to have a heart as well as a head, and both. You know, both. You're trying to do something for the client, and you have to know something. And that judge is there, in a way, as part of the furniture. I mean, I'm not a chair or a table. But nonetheless, it is the lawyers and the litigants who are the center of attention. How can we show that? How can we show it's a public building? How can we bring the public into this building so maybe they can use it, not even for law, but maybe to have an event, maybe to have local artists, maybe to have... And that's what he designed and he did. Transparent. You can go look at it. It's on that CBS Sunday Morning. I'm advertising it, but nonetheless. You can see it. The light comes in. The public does use it. And the best example that he gave us was the opposite of what is in Belgium, where it's like a procession. You see, a procession. You're going up to the king. Or, as they say of the Supreme Court, somebody said, the nine beetles in the Temple of Karnak. But that's not what we want. That's not what we want, he said. What we want, if you want to go into history, is look at the courthouse in England in the Strand. It's designed something called secular Gothic, which is a marketplace. And the lawyers are going back and forth across that marketplace doing their job. And then the courtrooms are around it, and the judge is part of the courtroom. But the place to focus on is where the action is, which is in front of that district judge. It's the district judge at the same level as the lawyer, of the jury, as the witness. Well, I'm telling you quite a lot about the courthouse, perhaps more than you want to know. But the object of that courthouse, like the courthouse in Johannesburg, South Africa, like the courthouse that they built in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, the one in Israel, like Bordeaux, designed by Richard Rogers, like Melbourne, like many modern courthouses, is to say to the public, this is your courthouse, we'd like you in here. And in Boston, they have come. They do use it. They do use it for events. And every week they have a large number. I don't have the numbers in front of me. The bar promotes high school students, and they take classes of high school students and bring them into the courthouse so they can see trials, so they learn something about law. You see, now you're touching me when I get to that point. Harry Cobb has really done that. And I think what Woodlock and I spent our time on was so worthwhile. It's corny, but it's true. That unless, say, this generation, the next generation, the one under the, after that, understand something about our government. When I say ours, it's theirs. And they have to approach it with an attitude that it's theirs, and not a cynical attitude that nobody can get anything done. I mean, if nobody can get anything done, then get down and get something done. I mean, you know, that's obvious and so forth. But can a building say that? Yeah, it can help. It can help say that. And that's why, to me, I feel it's very important. And it's not just the fault or not the fault of architects. It's a question of what people want. And so there we are. I won't get, I could be quite emotional about it. But
please join me in thanking Justice Breyer.
Thank you so much for enlivening us about the workings of the court. Join me in thanking them.
Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.